In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
Welcome to the Voice of Russia and its weekend program, The Red Line. Every weekend, we, Sergei Strokin, Mira Salganik, and Yekaterina Kudashkina, invite you to discuss the most significant events of the week. We are joined by Russian and international experts, politicians, scientists, and artists, sharing or opposing our views on the vast and increasingly interdependent world shared by all of us.
We want our program to be personal, provocative, and fair.
The subjects we are going to discuss this week, though so much different in every respect, still do have something in common. In each case, be it Syria or Cuba or the case of the U.S. Marine Private Bradley Manning, the situation is influenced to an extent by an external factor. Different situations, different factors, and different influence. So, we shall start with Syria, which is being rocked by unprecedented anti-governmental protests for more than a month now, with the opposition demanding political and economic reforms and, at the later stage, the resignation of the 45-year-old President Bashar al-Assad. We shall then move on to another region, the Caribbean, to look at Cuba, where the Communist Party Congress, the first in the last 14 years, coincided with the fifth anniversary of the Bay of Pigs failed operation aimed at toppling Fidel Castro regime. And finally, we shall discuss the story of the U.S. Marine Private Bradley Manning, still being held in solitary confinement in Quantico, Virginia. The Manning's case is rapidly developing into another international scandal just weeks after President Obama has announced his intention to take part in the 2012 presidential campaign.
Katya, as for Syria, as far as I remember, we have never discussed it before when we talked about Middle East upheaval. And we never spoke about Cuba as well. Or maybe we haven't spoken for a long time about Cuba.
Neither.
But both countries met a lot in world politics, and this was the case during the Cold War, and this is the case now.
Well, I guess that every country, every nation matters a lot depending on circumstances.
But what I mean to say that Syria and Cuba are not just geographical locations, they're two regional phenomena.
So let's have a closer look at those phenomena. Beyond the headlines, this is our first heading in which we shall take a look at the ongoing mass protests which gripped Syrian major cities with violent clashes, and this week with thousands demanding resignation of President Bashar al-Assad.
Let me remind our audience that it didn't happen overnight, and the first protests in Syria started in mid-March after a Facebook call for a day of dignity.
And those were the first manifestations of public discontent in a country that has long remained a key player in the regional politics.
Of such proportion, at least.
So, for several decades, the Assad family has remained in power. Please correct me, I think it was 48 years or something.
Something around that, yes.
43, I think. But anyway, look, 5 years, that doesn't matter in
that
this.
Decades,
indeed.
So, these protests have been unprecedented in scale and timing. Is that correct?
Yes.
Please, my experts, please do correct me if I'm
that's
wrong.
That's what I'm saying, yes. There were some minor riots, minor
signs of discontent.
They started
as minor. You know, what's interesting, they started as minor riots in the south of the country, in Deraa. And they started when, as I was told by witnesses, they started when kids, school kids, came out to streets demanding more freedom, just the way it started, the way they saw it was in Tunisia and in Egypt. But then the police overreacted and they took them to police departments and they jailed them for several hours. And then their relatives stepped in. And you can imagine their large families. So that's how it all started. It started from a trifle. And it, to my mind, it started from a mistake. So which means that the Deraa situation was literally sparked off.
Well, it was sparked off, but we shouldn't forget that the atmosphere was ready.
Yes, it was charged.
Precisely. It was charged because the news was pouring in from neighboring countries, and Deraa was never a very quiet place.
That's right. And besides, with the modern means of communication,
well, it all goes in a jiffy. So that's how police surely overreacted.
Oh, yes, they
but
overreacted.
It would have started, well, 3 days after, a week later.
So your point is that it was actually a matter of weeks for Mr. Bashar's
days.
Government.
Yes.
So and you mean to say that they were all ingredients of explosive situation there?
That's it.
Yeah, public discontent and the situation in neighboring countries. Neighboring, not literally neighboring, but in the countries of the region.
In the countries of the region.
with modern means of communication, plus, as we already said, with
the
pictures.
Constant impact of the mass media.
That's an information warfare.
It is.
So, as I see it, in more than a month after first protests broke out in the region of Deraa, like we said, after the first blood was spilled in clashes with police and, by the way, with unknown snipers, Syria and its leader find themselves at the crossroads now. So am I correct in my assumption?
Well, I have a feeling that for Syria, for President Assad, this is just more than standing at the crossroads.
What do you mean, more than?
Let me explain. The situation is really very dangerous in many ways. And if ethnic and religious strife continues, even Syria's sovereignty can be jeopardized. So what is at stake is nationhood, you see.
Well, God forbid it
forbid.
Disintegrates, because this is a real crisis involving, regions far beyond the Middle East.
Well, you know, Mira, some analysts are saying that under the worst scenario, Syria even might fall apart. So just like you said, can you imagine the consequences for the region?
Oh, indeed. Terrible. So just let us keep the fingers crossed that it doesn't happen, at least not immediately.
Yes, but today all eyes are on Bashar Assad, on Syria's president, and this is really a moment of truth for him. And he has to decide whether he would act as a classical old dictator or he would just prove himself to be a strong, capable, forward-looking leader who is not scared of bold reforms, reforms his father, late President Hafez Assad, would have never accepted, I'm sure.
So now then, I suggest we could have a closer look at President Assad, as the future developments will largely depend
Junior Assad.
On him. On the President Assad.
Yes.
Today, he does face a clear choice, and one option is to be driven by old political habits, by inertia, and probably yield to the opposition in the government he is facing, and he was facing when he first introduced his reforms several years back, correct? So, and the second choice would be to go on with reforms. But the trouble is, I think that really there is very little time left for him now.
At the same time, we have to understand that this havoc is also a chance for dignified survival for him. This is an opportunity for introducing changes, as I said, and he can pioneer changes.
But I think it's a little bit too complicated a situation. It's not all that simple.
Yeah, but
he wants changes and he introduces changes.
But
there's a lot of opposition within the rulers.
That's a second. He didn't even verbalize it. He didn't announce changes. He said lifting the emergency law.
You're mistaken. 2 weeks ago, there was a Congress in which he announced changes, and he has been announcing changes for quite a while. But he stopped in midway to introducing them because the package of reform has already been there, but it has not been confirmed by the government. That's the point. And that's the silly thing about the whole situation, because the reforms have been worked out. And he invited a team of best Western experts to help him with the economic reforms. So there have been some economic reforms, but there have been no political reforms.
There is more talk about proposed reforms, as far as I feel, than actually even a desire to implement them. They are being discussed, they are being put away, the emergency laws lifting has been announced, but not actually put into practice.
That takes time.
Well, look, it does take time, but there are situations when there is fire, you don't calculate your time, you do things. And I think that the country is close to a fire. And I have a feeling that the president doesn't have the guts to go into real changes.
Meaning the possibility?
Or political will, if
political
you want me
will.
To be more politically correct.
Meaning he's too cautious.
Hesitant.
Well, I think this is a very complicated question, you see. This is not only the question of guts, but really the key question is what kind of legacy does Assad want to leave in Syria?
Why are we already talking about legacy?
Because he's at the crossroads, you see. Either he would go into history as an old dictator, as his father, or he will introduce change, it will succeed, and if it works, he can reemerge as the leader of a new democratic Syria. This is that legacy what I'm talking about, you see. But Mira, you mentioned his performance these days, you see. But do you remember how he became a president 11 years back,
yes, no? Yes,
that
indeed.
Was a very lively episode of Syrian politics.
Well,
also.
Indeed, I remember, don't you, Katya?
No.
He was a young student, good-looking, incidentally, nice boy. studying ophthalmology, if you please, in London, not even thinking of a political career. Why should he?
And he met his future wife in London, if I'm not mistaken.
So things were shaping up just lovely for the young boy. He was handsome, and so was the girl, incidentally. And then, not suddenly, but after some kind of protracted, let us say, illness, Hafid Assad goes...
Passes away?
Passes away, goes to the better place. And the old guard, I don't know, only then it dawned on them that the president, I mean Hafiz, didn't leave a successor. So the ophthalmologist has been quickly whisked away from London, brought back to homeland. And in a matter of, was it, Sergei, days or weeks, the budding ophthalmologist emerged as a full-fledged president.
That was just weeks, but that was totally unexpected for him also.
That's
interesting. For him it was also
a
shock.
Mainly. Well, the point was, as far as I see, was to choose a person who would be definitely a heir to Hafiz Assad. And would be innocuous and timid enough not to revolt against the old guard. So the choice was...
But initially, Bashar was not considered as a successor. And as I understand, Hafiz Assad made stake on his oldest son, you see, who died in an accident.
He died in an accident. Your point was that he wasn't groomed for future presidency. Bashar Assad.
So I mean to say that there was no option because there was only one Assad remaining, you see, who was an ophthalmologist studying in London.
But you know what's interesting? For God's sake, is it absolutely unheard of that when a president dies, the next one doesn't have the surname of Assad? Is it absolutely unheard of? Why should it happen? Look, it was 11 years ago already.
My point is that...
As if it was 11 ages back.
This man is young. He's 45 years old. He's got an appeal. He's got a charisma. He's a Western-oriented politician. When he needed to work out the package of reforms, he invited experts from the West. So I think that actually places him quite apart from people like Gaddafi, from Hosni Mubarak, from Saleh, from Ben Ali. So he's soft-spoken. He tried to cultivate an image of a modest leader with reformist leanings. But from the very start, he was surrounded by the old guard of his father's men, and it largely determined his politics.
This is the key problem, as far as I see it. He had a very limited number of options from the very start. He had very limited field for maneuver. That's not the question of his guts or his decisiveness, but when you are surrounded with the old apparatus of your father and you're driven by the inertia of old political traditions, so how can you act? So you're very much limited.
And until now, he was sending mixed signals. So on the one hand, now he announced a lift of the 40-year-old emergency law, really, which is bold move, which was a key point, which was a key opposition demand. But it does seem that he is a little bit behind the developments now.
He's a little bit late.
But at the same time, he understands the need for change. And I selected a couple of quotes from Bashar to illustrate this point. One point is, the world is rapidly changing around us and we have to keep up with developments, he said.
Perfectly true.
Yeah. And here is another quote. We have to focus on the demands and the aspirations of the people or there will be a sense of anger.
Which is perfectly true, too. But on the other hand, he's talking about what is generally described as conspiracy theories. He's talking about some foreign hand which is trying to put his country on flames.
I don't like conspiracy theories, be it Syria or other country, Katya, you know?
Anyway, we all know that all kinds of influences are there.
After all, they do exist. Only the talk of them makes them, you know, exaggerated.
But in Syrian context, I think that he has a point to some extent when he speaks about conspiracy.
Well, some experts insist that Syria is turning into a kind of a battleground between Shia Iran and Sunni Saudi Arabia. Bashar's father, the late President Hafiz, had quite a clash, some of the religious, we may call
them. What kind of?
Well, that was in 82, if I'm not mistaken, and he suppressed the movement against his... I mean, sort of a dissident movement, you may call it. It was a movement of the Sunnis, and Hafiz Assad crushed it with real brutality. So one of the factors which his son now has in mind is that the Sunnis want to take revenge for them.
But isn't his wife a Sunni?
Who's?
Bashar Assad's. I think she's a Sunni.
I'm afraid I don't know.
He's Alawi and she's Sunni.
So you see, the family of Bashar are Alawi, and it's a small sect. And if we go into this, Kurtz, I promise you we shall never come out of it. Unscathed. That's a long... We could make a program on it. Interesting.
That's a very interesting point. And the religious and their relations between different religious communities in Syria.
Well, this is very interesting background on that religious strife. But my point is that when we speak about conspiracy theories, it should not be restricted to Muslim factor, which is obvious there, and the struggle between Shia and Sunnis. I've seen that this week Washington Post reported that according to newly released WikiLeaks cables, the State Department has been secretly financing Syrian opposition groups and all kinds of opposition projects for at least 5 years. You know, this is something, really.
Did you think they were not financing them?
Not me.
No, they were financing
it. That's
proper... they financed it. But the question is to what extent it contributed to the upheaval.
That's the question, really.
Well, I've seen that story, and it says that the U.S. aid continued going into the hands of the Syrian opposition even after President Obama began his, so to say, re-engagement policy with the Syrian government. If you remember, before his starting this policy, there was a real low in the relations between Syria and Iran.
Syria was considered a sort of a rogue state along with Iran.
Well, Mr. Bush sometimes listed as a rogue state and sometimes not. You know, he was not exactly
not
consistent.
Not only Mr. Bush, we had some dignified visitors from Israel here in Moscow, and they kept on saying that Moscow, we should not cooperate with Syria. We should not sell arms to Syria.
That's not surprising.
It was in full compliance with...
But Syria is still formally in the state of war with Israel. So what's the big question about it?
That was them not the question of being with war, but the idea behind that was that Syria is a rogue state which can't be trusted, which is run by irresponsible leadership. So it is very dangerous to sell arms to Syria. This was the point which was made by high-ranking Israel officials in recent years in Moscow.
What would you expect from an Israeli high-rank official?
Absolutely.
At present context, too. Sergei, for God's sake.
That's right. But now let's move back to WikiLeaks cables, to leaked cables, be it ironically, the diplomatic cable, which was dating back to April 2009, which means it originated under Mr.
Obama's administration,
says that some of the projects funded by the United States, if discovered by the Syrian government, would have been perceived as, and I quote, an attempt to undermine the Assad regime. That's not surprising to me, really.
Not really, but on the other hand...
It's plain work. It's plain work of secret services.
That's what they're paid for.
That's what they're paid for.
Put it very, very bluntly. But look, you might say that Bashar Assad, of course, in his mistrust of the West and foreign forces and talk about conspiracies, does have a point. But there are, I'm quite sure, foreign influences. It's difficult to assess them right now. It's all under the carpet and things. But you cannot write off all the discontent of Syrian people, all what is going on right now in Damascus and around, on foreign influences alone. We do live in an interconnected world,
absolutely,
but each one of us has got a right and executes it to commit his own blunders.
Of course,
so
Mira.
So be very careful when we speak about this conspiracy theory.
We always need to be careful when you're trying to analyze a situation. But of course, no conspiracy would ever have worked if it were ungrounded.
Absolutely.
And the ground is there.
Well prepared.
Anyway, the question is, how much time there is left for Mr. Assad? And here is Dr. Murhaf Jojati, professor of political science and international affairs at the George Washington University and also professor at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies.
My basic question is, with all that is going on in Syria now, we can still see some basic differences from other despot regimes because Mr. Assad is a young person. He is rather popular with his electorate. And what's most important to me, at least, is that he's trying to do something. He's supposed to lift the emergency law. He's introducing some reforms. So what do you think, how could the situation develop? Along what lines?
He has made a lot of concessions to the protesters. Some of these concessions are, from a perspective of the protesters, are insignificant, like the shuffling of the cabinet. Others are more significant, like the lifting of the emergency laws. But in the end, Mr. Assad has not met the demands of the protesters. There has not been yet the establishment of political parties. He does not look like he is going to release political prisoners. So we are still in a situation of a stalemate and a crisis.
Do you think he will still have the time to introduce more changes closer towards the Congress of his party?
Well, the more time that elapses without any concessions to the protesters and the more lethal force is used against the protesters, the less chances that he has of success. Again, the use of violence against unarmed protesters is angering everyone, whether domestically or internationally, and the increased use of these security measures are going to inflame the situation.
So what is your forecast? Is he going to go, or perhaps he could still survive in power?
I think he still has some room to maneuver, but this window of opportunity is closing very quickly.
So what would you suggest he has to do in this situation?
I think he has to immediately make public trials for those officers who have used force against the protesters. He has to show that he is truly serious about combating corruption, and this is not merely through speeches or through words, but through actual action. So, in other words, he has to take significant steps rather than cosmetic steps in order to show the body politic that he truly is a reformer and not simply an authoritarian leader.
Is there a lot of opposition to the reforms within the ruling elite?
The ruling elite is very comfortable with the status quo, and the deeper the reforms, of course, the more the elite is going to be alienated. So this is truly a pull and a push between the ruling elite and the protesters.
Which means that Mr. Asset in a lose-lose situation, so to say.
Not necessarily, because as you pointed out earlier, he still has some support in the body politic, and he needs to develop that support. He needs to balance things out, develop enough reforms to satisfy the crowd, and yet not give up the entire house so as not to lose the ruling elite.
Suppose Mr. Asset still has to go. Who could come to his place?
There is going to be a vacuum of power, and this could leash and unleash a power struggle in the elite. It is going to unleash a power struggle also with society. So I think in his absence, in a vacuum of power, there is going to be more chaos.
And he is always speaking about some external factors in this situation. How strong is the influence of external factors?
Well, there might be an external hand, but certainly most of the unrest is domestically caused. That is because for the past 43 years, the Syrians have been kept under martial law. Also, they have taken into account the Syrian body politic, what is going on regionally. And so it is a new era. It is a time of change that the Syrian population has seized on.
Do I get you right that the situation is dire, but there is still a way out if Mr. Assad has enough courage to move rapidly and to oppose those who are against the reforms in his own establishment? Is my vision correct?
Yes, I think that vision is correct. The situation is dire. He still has a window of opportunity, but a window that is closing very rapidly.
Thank you very much.
You're tuned to the Voice of Russia.
And now we are turning to Red Lines, second heading, Between the Lines, where we usually discuss the most interesting and notable publication of the week. So, since one of the most notable events of the week is the 6th Communist Party Congress in Cuba, the first Communist Party forum in 14 years, and the first Congress held after Comandante Fidel Castro stepped down as Cuban leader, naming as successor his brother Raúl, we have chosen for discussion Carlos Alberto Montaner's piece carried by the Miami Herald under the title Cuban Communists Headed for Oblivion. So, it is reported that some bold, unorthodox decisions were taken at the ruling party Congress aimed at rejuvenating old political and economic system with its aging leaders. So, we propose to discuss whether Cuba's present system is heading for oblivion or perhaps a new lease of life. Or something else, perhaps.
Well, I have noticed that speaking at the forum, Cuban leader Raúl Castro was unusually frank. He openly said that his country's economics is on the brink of a precipice and proposed a number of truly revolutionary changes. Well, Raúl Castro is 80 and he proposed a 10-year tenure on office limits for Cuban highest officials. And in realities of Cuban socialism, this is really a shockingly new change.
Oh, yes. And provided that he's 80, which means that perhaps the ruling elite, which, like we're saying, is aging, they are still aware of the need of reform, which is very important. First signals of their reforms started coming in some 2 to 3 years ago.
That was not the only change. Let me continue. So among the other urgent steps towards rescue of the economy, he named expanding possibilities for private enterprise, lifting bans on buying property and new cars, as well as cancellation of food rationing. As things stand now, Cubans are allowed only to trade property of equal worth. So there's no trade as such, and new cars are allocated by authorities, not bought.
Oh, really?
Those are really revolutionary changes.
See, it's an interesting system.
Recognizable, no?
Well, not exactly. We were still buying cars in the Soviet Union. We were not...
Just before it, don't let us go into it. Cuba, by all accounts, I mean hostile or friendly, by all accounts, is in need of reforms. As Carlos Alberto Montaner writes in the Miami Herald, after 52 years of dictatorship without a hostile parliament or an opposition that could hinder the government's work, the six basic elements that determine the quality of life of any modern society have been decayed into regular nightmares. And these are food, potable water, housing, electricity, communications, and transport. The question is how to reform and who is to do the reforming.
I just wanted to make a short remark that, of course, this story to me seems a little bit tragic because it's quite explicable. It's been written by an emigrant. Of course, there are a lot of problems, but not as grim as he tries to depict, because Cuba has been seen as a potentially prospective market by many global market players. And they started to build hotels, they started to build houses, and they started to develop tourism there, like I say, some 3 to 4 years ago.
Yeah, first project some of my friends went there.
No, I mean the international companies, not the Cuban companies, but the international companies came in and started to develop the market.
Because they've been allowed. All.
That's right. You have a point, because they have been allowed after all those years, which means that the situation has been gradually shifting from that stubborn block of isolated economy, which we are now talking
about. Well, Kaze, Sergei, you could also sort of, you know, chime in. We've been talking a second ago about Syria. Is there the time and the political will?
You're
and
absolutely
are
correct.
People still content to wait for another decade or two?
Of course.
Same goes for Cuba.
Absolutely. But the difference is...
There is fighting in Syria, in Cuba, thank God.
And there's another difference. We know who could carry on with reforms in Syria. And now, here, the key question is who, which is probably more important than how. Is that correct?
But do you know the answer?
I don't think so. Because Fidel Castro is...
But there's a lot of talk about that Marina Murillo.
But do you mean the 50-year-old economist who is former army officer and former minister of the economy?
I mean him.
So he's said to owe total allegiance to the general president and to be committed to retaining the basic elements of the communist system, although eliminating paternalism, which is, well, a description for a future here.
But the question is, will he succeed?
And
he's called Rawls' ideological stepson. And Rawls wants to build socialism without subsidies and capitalism without markets. But that's impossible. I recall reading that Cuba used to cost the Soviet Union, can you imagine, $1 million a day?
Sweet memories. Doesn't it all remind you of the Soviet Union on the eve of perestroika, Sergei? Command economics producing God knows what and making all of us to queue up for every little thing, or not so little thing, from a carrot to a car. Don't you remember it all?
Mira, yes, perestroika, definitely I remember. Good talk, no goods. You're right, absolutely.
I think Mira was referring to time before perestroika, not the perestroika.
Perestroika
the perestroika
also,
was a continuation also, of the times also. Before it.
But will Cuban perestroika work if it is really to be something similar to perestroika?
Is the leadership bent on perestroika? That's the question too, don't you think so?
Do you think that perestroika is the only way to...
I'm asking the question. Perestroika is, as we conceive it now, perceive it now, something total. And if the Cuban leadership is bent on, you know, sort of minor, almost cosmetic reforms, then they're bound to
fail. I think there
fail.
Are two major scenarios of transfer from planned socialist economics to something more liberal, which is one is our perestroika and the second scenario is the Chinese. So it's up to the Cubans which way they would choose. So here's what Miami Herald is writing. Just let me quote. Although Cubans continue to repeat slogans, almost no one believes in Marxism-Leninism. The government tries to escape from the system's chronic failures by creating a few spaces that might allow private initiative to alleviate the disaster of collectivism. They applaud revolutionary mottos, young people, Karl Marx, the little old man who invented hunger. The adults, in confidence, acknowledge this outlook. It's the double standards again, so isn't it recognizable?
Here it is definitely recognizable. And nowadays,
and
a lot of people in Russia are nostalgic for the past, for the Soviet golden age and the
communism. I think you're generalizing. I think some details there.
I can give you some latest facts. The communist leader, Gennady Zyuganov, last week announced he will run for presidency at 2012 Russia's presidential election.
Absolutely amazing decision for a leader of an opposition party.
But I'm sure he will win around 20% of vote.
That's your forecast.
Yes.
Well, of course, there is a large communist electorate in Russia, no doubt, but mainly those are people of a rather advanced in age. The people of the past, you may call them. But don't you remember the discontent of that time? The acid jokes, the constant grumbling. What I actually want to say is that now the three of us seated in this studio, we differ in age, we differ in ethnicity, we differ in our life experience, of course, but we are of the same blood, and this is the Soviet blood, which is still circulating in our systems. I'm telling all that to come to a kind of a conclusion. I do believe that we in the Soviet Union, ex-Soviet Union, are capable of understanding what's going on in Cuba much better than anyone else, much better than the nations of East Europe, because we have been living in it for 75 years, if you please.
Oh, yes, I agree with you, and we know how painful the transfer goes.
And how inevitable it is for Cuba.
We know there are different ways.
Katya, I know that you are still fascinating with Cuba romantic. So many people are.
No.
And I also like them. But
no, I know there are
they
two
are
models.
They're facing really hard...
Future.
Not future, choice.
That's a hard choice they're facing.
Yes,
I
it
agree.
Is.
Well, I also agree about that Soviet blood in my veins, Mira. We can't help, unfortunately. My point is, let's come back to Cuba's Party Congress. I've noticed that it opened on the 50th anniversary of Cuba's triumph in the Bay of Pigs.
Sorry, Sergei, what do you mean you have noticed? It has been timed this way to remind Cuba of the moment of glory.
Half a century back, on April 17, 1961, 1,400, if I'm not mistaken, Cuban exiles, who were supplied and backed by the CIA and Pentagon, attempted to invade their homeland and overthrow Fidel Castro. And it took Fidel, can you imagine, just 72 hours to smash the intervention.
And the world gate.
Yes. And you know what President Kennedy said? How could we have been so stupid?
I wonder what he meant. Anyway, do you know, Sergei, there's been a book written by Jim Ressenberger, who, in fact, wrote his new book, The Brilliant Disaster, JFK, Castro, and America's Doomed Invasion of Cuba's Bay of Pigs. And it was published on the 17th of April, 2011. And
I've seen a brief review, but I didn't read it.
In Fox News.
Yes.
I thought that his analysis was quite apt in many ways. What I want to emphasize is that, according to Ressenberger, all American foreign interventions after the Bay of Pigs, including Libya, for instance, have something in common. And just let me quote, it is their tendency to merit the observation Arthur Schlesinger Jr. made in his journal after the 1961 debacle when the presidential advisor wrote, we not only look like imperialists, we look like ineffectual imperialists, which is worse, and we look like stupid, ineffectual imperialists, which is worst of all. And I think that's a brilliant quotation.
Yes, and after the Bay of Pigs, Commandante Fidel was basking in glory, and he overnight became an idol, an icon for the whole left world, not only for Cuba, because it was under his leadership that the tiny revolutionary Freedom Island humiliated the ogre, the imperialist United States. This is how they seen it.
Yes, and it lasted a long time, and the hella of that adoration is still sort of, you know, hanging around.
He's still there.
Yes,
he's still a hero. He's still a national hero.
I'm telling you, Katya, look, even the Soviet missiles crisis in Cuba, which actually put humanity on brink of nuclear war, did not diminish Castro's charisma.
Oh, yes.
And things. But before long, Che Guevara came, and he changed the situation. What belonged to Castro was taken away by Che Guevara and
made
even more beautiful. every point of view.
So the curiosity and romanticism surrounding Cuba's Che Guevara, the revolutionary hero, has refused to abate. Is that correct? Even slightly? In the 43 years. Do you mean that?
Yes, I do. Don't you agree?
43 years after his death. Okay, but Regis Debray, the famous French philosopher and writer, gave an apt explanation of Che's phenomenon by stating that Che has given the youth a banner under which one is proud to die. It's a really romantic approach.
It is romantic and it's catchy, and I'm sure that many, many countries that have their revolutionary movement, Latin America, Japan, India, Germany, can thank Che for it. It's still there.
It's still there.
Katya and Mira, Che is a symbol of permanent revolution.
Yes.
Will continue to attract every young generation, no doubt. Whether this is Cuba or Russia or Sri Lanka, I don't know. There's no doubt about it. But what happens after a revolution's triumph? That's the question.
By the same token, those who insist on impeding the natural evolution of history end up provoking devastating catastrophes. That's a fact. That's a maxim that you cannot debate. And I think that we all agree that the Castro brothers have been trying to not only to stop history's development, but did it insistently and, well, should I say bravely, that too.
To stop history's development?
Yes, that's what they did. They're still doing it.
They're still doing that? What do you mean? Could you explain
that? I mean, yes, I can. Yes, I can. If you still try to insist on the letter of socialism society, which didn't triumph anywhere on the...
How about Scandinavia?
Well, she'll come in it.
You know, it's a very interesting subject. I suggest we should talk about it in one of our later programs.
I also suggest that we talk about Finland.
Finland.
Did you mean that? All right, we shall...
No, I meant Norway. I meant Sweden. I meant countries which combine in their economics both capitalist and socialist elements.
You said combine.
That's right.
You said combine. That makes all the difference.
Yes.
Cuba wanted it. Chemically pure. Doesn't work. But the effort was brave.
The effort?
And I'm sorry for the
has
people.
Been brave. So the question to me is, which direction is Cuba taking?
And now we are joined by Vitaly Makarov, former head of the Cuba section at the International Department of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union.
This is probably the most difficult question. The point is that they are not turning away from the ideas of socialism, and they have their reasons for this. To start with, they're historical. Look at China and Vietnam, where capitalism is developing alongside socialism. At least political power belongs to the Communist Party, whereas the economy is evolving on the basis of market principles. This is probably what the Cubans are striving for, but they have encountered some difficulties. My conviction, and it's not just based on beliefs but also on half-century-long knowledge of Cuba, is that their situation is that it isn't just domestic factors that play an important role. And these domestic factors have been spoken about by Raúl and Fidel before him. The dogmatism and the single-party system that were major restrictions for our country and for other socialist countries. So on top of this, there are external factors. The ongoing blockade of Cuba, which is continuing. The UN has been voting for the lifting of the US blockade of Cuba. In my view, these are the most significant factors that will determine the further development of Cuba. There is one other that seems paramount to me. I thought that along with Raúl, there would be a team of young leaders coming to power, but this didn't happen. Evidently, the very system that they themselves denounce has not allowed these people to come to power, and I know for a fact that there were a lot of them. They were preparing for a reserve, so to say, a team of people from their own camp who didn't end up making it. There are plans to build up such a reserve within 5 years. Plus, there's natural attrition. People will come and go. I think that the most important thing ahead of them, in my view, is moving out of a plane of resistance between socialism and capitalism to aligning themselves to a new center of political influence in the world. Finding which of these centers Cuba will work and partner with is the key. Before the BCON was the so-called socialist camp, whereas now there are lots to choose from. The triad of US, Canada, and Mexico, with the US at the helm. There's China, there's Europe, there's the Asian countries, and also the Latin American countries of which Cuba is a part. Plus, there's a new configuration of BRICS, which I think has a promising future. Cuba needs to choose.
You are listening to the Voice of Russia, one of the oldest radio stations in the world.
And now we move to the third heading, the man in the news. And I suppose this time there are two men in the news, the U.S. Army Private Bradley Manning and the U.S. President Barack Obama.
You mean both of them?
Well, Mira, I think I can explain what Katya means. It seems that in order to win another presidential term, President Obama will have to sort of reinvent himself and reignite his base. As I see it, in an uphill battle for presidency, every soldier would matter for him, including Private Bradley Manning.
But just to remind our listeners, since last July, Private Manning was kept at the Marine Corps brig in Quantico in conditions that have become a subject of growing alarm both in the United States and in other countries. So the controversy over U.S. Army Private Bradley Manning, suspected of giving classified materials to WikiLeaks, initially seen as a purely U.S. domestic story, is rapidly growing into a large-scale international scandal.
Well, that's right. The scandal is not only raising uneasy questions within the United States, but is also putting Obama's administration at odds with some of his key allies in Europe.
Yes, Mira, and also it casts a long shadow over Washington's efforts to sort of champion global drive for peace and democracy, which was proclaimed by President Obama as one of his key tasks, as far as I remember. And it also questions Washington's role in advising other nations from China and Russia to Iran and Myanmar on how to safeguard basic freedoms and human rights.
Well, isn't it a bit too strong?
But there's a sort of a credibility gap in that, you know? Well, let me explain what I mean. By saying so, I'm not trying to dramatize the story of Bradley Manning. But for me, Manning's story evokes memories of Steven Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan. You know, you remember that blockbuster that conquered continents with its irresistible truth about a group of brave American servicemen headed by Captain John Miller, which during the Second World War landed in enemy's rear to find and bring home Private James Ryan.
Oh yes, Sergei, and now there's a peaceful regiment, so to say, made up of U.S. professors of law, international human rights activists, U.N. officials, and European MPs is involved in a mission which can be described as Saving Private Manning.
That's right. And the difference is that all of them are not servicemen, but unarmed civilians, having to operate not in the enemy rear, but in the homeland of Mr. Manning, the citadel of democracy, America of President Obama. They have to fight an uphill battle in the leading democracy run by Nobel Prize winner, who in the year 2008 won the hearts and minds of millions of Americans as well as foreign admirers by negating the heritage of his predecessor, the last U.S. war president George Bush, whose rule, as you remember, was largely associated with Guantanamo, with CIA secret prisons in Europe, and with torture chambers of Iraqi prison Abu Ghraib.
You're right. You're absolutely right. So which means that perhaps it is some kind of a legacy of Mr. Bush still dooming on Mr. Obama. But some may argue, and I think I support their position, that comparing Private Ryan and Private Manning is rather inappropriate. Because Ryan is a soldier, a warrior, while Manning is a traitor who has presumably downloaded to WikiLeaks some 250,000 sensitive State Department and Pentagon cables on the U.S. operation in Iraq. So his move, in fact, hurt the U.S. international standing. It undermined national security. And the question whether Bradley is a soldier or a traitor, shall we say, it is yet to be answered. But personally, I have answered it to myself. He's a traitor to me.
Well, I tend to agree with you, Carter. He was in active service. He was under the oath of allegiance, so to say. You don't break it. If you do break it, you pay for it. This is the straightforward approach to it. And I couldn't compromise on it. But the British Guardian believes that Manning can be seen as, and now listen, I'm quoting it, a soldier brave enough to have allegedly released information which should be in their second. How does it go then? Oh yes, that should be in the public domain and not kept secret because it recounts his atrocities it committed in a war. Would the British be so objective if the chap was a Britisher?
I'm not sure.
Neither am I.
Well, even if Bradley Manning has violated U.S. law in his transaction with WikiLeaks, because formally it has not been established yet.
That's a fact.
But the conditions of his detention in Quantico have already become a matter of concern, and that's another point of this story.
Let me tell you, Katya, there are nearly 300 U.S. pundits, including President Obama's former law colleague and most eminent legal scholars, and Lawrence Tribe, one of Obama's Howard Law School professors, is one of them. So, in an open letter, scholars stated that Manning's treatment, I'm quoting, violates his person and his liberty without due process of law, and in a way it administers cruel and unusual punishment of a sort that cannot be constitutionally inflicted even upon someone convicted of terrible offenses, not to mention someone merely accused of such offenses.
I could subscribe to this. First you try a man, then you decide on the punishment.
Well, even if he's a traitor, he must not be treated like a dog, obviously.
Worse than a dog. Because what one reads and hears about the conditions of the treatment...
Well, they're harsh.
Well, to put it mildly. But let me remind you how exactly 2 years back, in April 2009, during President Obama's first visit to Europe, a 30,000-strong crowd greeted him in Prague with standing ovation. By that time, Europe was caught really in a grip of Obama mania, a kind of adoration, affection no other United States president could ever hope to have on the continent. And it was similar only to one another event that I can recreate in my mind, how 22 years back, when Europe was gripped in Gorby fever, Mikhail Sergeyevich Gorbachev was greeted in a similar manner as the pioneer of perestroika, of glasnost and new thinking.
Well, Mira, but time goes on, and it seems that by today the enthusiasm over Obama has largely evaporated in Europe. And in a letter to President Obama, German Parliament last week, that was a human rights committee, so they called the conditions of Bradley Manning's detention unnecessarily hard and having a penalizing character.
But those statements, by the way, came as the Obama administration denied access to Bradley Manning,
yes,
of the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, Juan Mendes. And the same negative reply awaited member of Congress Denis Kucinich, whose repeated attempts to visit Manning in prison have all failed. And that is another story, which means here's a third dimension to this story.
So all in all, what we have is that weeks after Barack Obama has officially announced his participation in 2012 presidential campaign, more and more people both in the United States and in the world are asking, who is Mr. Obama? Is he the same person we voted for and supported in 2008 and after? What if everything we think we know about president's political position is wrong? Writes Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. Mind you, the story is not about Manning, but about Obama's domestic and international failures, or how they call it, losing seasons. Failure to close Guantanamo issue, Afghanistan and Libya among them.
I'm not advocating Mr. Obama in this situation, but still we should assume that the processes of change do take time. I'm not sure that Mr. Obama really wanted to support Mr. Manning in this situation. I'm sure he doesn't want to engage in another conflict with Pentagon, and Pentagon is really feeling very hard about Mr. Manning, isn't he? Anyway, my question is just, who is Private Manning? Is he a traitor or is he a whistleblower? And now we're joined by Joe Glanville, the editor with the Index on Censorship, a London-based organization which, in fact, voiced its support for Julian Assange.
Thank you, Joe. It's very nice of you to join us. Do you see Mr. Manning as a traitor, the way he's described in the United States, or perhaps he's someone who wants to assert the truth?
Well, I mean, what label you give him obviously depends where you're sitting, and as far as the government's concerned, he's a traitor in having leaked information that, as far as America's concerned, endangers national security. But he is as far as he is concerned, he is a whistleblower, that the information that he came across is the case. I have to say that he is the man who leaked this information, because that nothing's been proven yet. Then as far as he was concerned, he was privy to information that he felt was in the public interest and that he needed to leak.
Both ways, whether the investigation manages to confirm that he was the whistleblower or perhaps not, do you think that the way he's kept in his solitary confinement and all this scandal around the conditions in which he's kept, do you think that perhaps he could be treated like that in any country as a traitor, or still it is a violation of human rights?
Of course it's a violation of his human rights, and I believe now that he's being moved to a prison with much better conditions where he'll no longer be in solitary, where he can associate with other prisoners, and he'll get some time every day outside as well. So I think it's absolutely clear, and it's been a matter of great concern for human rights organisations that he's been treated very, very, very severely, and clearly the administration wanted to punish him. So I'm delighted that he's now been put in another prison in much, much better conditions.
I think that the timing when he is going to be moved to another prison is not established yet, is it? Or am I mistaken?
That I didn't know. I just know that I don't know what the status is, whether he's been moved yet or not, but that's what I understand is going to happen.
Do you think that it is perhaps, shall I put it, natural reaction of the Department of Defense towards someone they believe is a traitor? Or is it still a fault of the current U.S. administration? I mean, the way this case has been handled.
Well, I think it's always the case. I mean, I can look at sort of examples here in the United Kingdom that when anyone leaks confidential government information, might be top secret or might be at a much lower level, then they are always treated very harshly. We've had cases here in recent years where civil servants have been prosecuted under the Official Secrets Act, and that's always a great concern for us because most of the time the information that's being leaked is very clearly of public interest and in the public interest. But as far as government is concerned, it's their documents that they want to keep secret, and they always, in my experience, act extremely harshly. So to make an example of whistleblowers, there needs to be greater protection for whistleblowers, but one does have to recognise that there is information that the government needs to protect, but there does need to be a balance.
That's right, because now what we are witnessing is some kind of a dilemma. It is always a question if a person should act in the public interest or should he ignore some facts which actually harm the society, but protecting those facts would be in the interest of the government. But do you think that perhaps there is still some way out?
How do you mean some way out?
I mean, some solution to this dilemma.
Well, I think the solution is that there has to be a recognition that some information that is leaked, even if it's leaked without the approval of a corporation or a government, there has to be a recognition that some information can be in the public interest and there is a justification for the leaking of information. I don't think that, you know, the leaking of information per se should mean that somebody is prosecuted and certainly never treated in the ways that Bradley Manning has been treated.
But do you think that really makes a difference whether a person is paid for the information or not?
It can do. I just think it depends on the circumstances. I think in most cases, whistleblowers don't tend to be paid. They're doing it as a matter of conscience or of great sort of ethical concern or concern around human rights or concern that a piece of information needs to be made public. But I think it just depends on the context.
Well, Joe, thank you very much.
And with this, we end this edition of Redline, brought to you by the Voice of Russia radio station. It was presented by its founders, Sergei Strokin and Mira Salganik, and myself, Ekaterina Kudashkina. Thank you very much for staying with us. Goodbye, and take care.
Take care and goodbye.
So long.
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 Goodbye.
So long.